Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I forgot to do the countdown. Hang on, I got to wait for the clock to go.
All right.
Okay, no. There we go.
This is All About Wine.
Wine.
Talk show. Oh, wine industry since 2009. Featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Rod.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
Yes.
From coast to coast.
Around the world.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that. I love that.
Watch you then, Tommy. During the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwineptr.
Again,
that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwineptr. All About Wine is on.
Is on.
Here's Ron.
There he is.
Yay!
Oh. He's bundled up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, not too bad today. Yeah.
No. But it's still. What is it out? What is it outside now? Let's see.
I don't know.
Unlock the stupid phone. Oh, yeah. It's 70 degrees. That's a.
Is it still? Wow. Balmy.
Turn the heat on.
Yeah.
And I'm in
the
mountains area of Florida. You're along the coast.
I'm
in the upper elevation here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're going to get a little bit. Yeah. Colder than the elevation. Today was nice. I played golf yesterday. What is today? Thursday. Yeah, I played golf yesterday, and it was really nice out there. It was just a beautiful day for golf. And I'm playing tomorrow, and it's supposed to be cloudy and chances of showers. But you know, it's just like they say, they'll go fast, so I can handle that. But then Sunday I'm playing, and it's only supposed to hit like 61 degrees or something. I don't know. It's 65, something like that is the high. And that's just cold for golf. That, you know, and all the people up north who play golf and, you know, just above freezing weather saying, what you talking about? Now, well, to me.
And after they get done swimming or something, they go play golf.
Yeah.
They go play golf first and then go swimming.
Yeah, that's it, you know. So, it's just cool for me. I play golf. I'll play golf with a guy from Ohio, and he'll be out there in a tank top and in shorts, and he'll go, oh, this is great weather, you know. And I will wear shorts, but I will have long socks on, and I will have layered on the upper body and all that. So,
is it possible that they're just saying that, you know, just are they just saying it, but deep down inside they're freezing? They're like, oh, this is terrible.
I can't
believe I'm here playing golf. Sure is warm out here, you know.
Yeah, I know. People I was at the winery one day, and there was a bunch of people in there, and it was in the winter, and everybody had on their coats and jackets and, you know, long pants. Nobody was wearing shorts, so the girls weren't wearing skirts or anything. And here comes this couple walking up the sidewalk, and the guy had on a T-shirt and shorts. And I says, oh, here comes somebody from Michigan. And they all looked at me and said, you know him? I go, no. And he walks in the door and I go, where are you from? He goes, Michigan. I go, see, they just
dress
code. You know, anything above, I don't know what, 47 degrees, you know, they throw on the shorts and a T-shirt. And, so it's, you know, you live down here for a while and you start acclimating to the warm weather, and then anything below 70 degrees, you start shivering. So, but the whole country, I just saw a map, the whole country is having cold right now. Florida's the only place that's in the 70s. We feel bad for them. We do. We really do.
We do.
Stay there. Don't come to Florida, but we feel bad for you. Come down here on vacation, but don't move. a little sport note here, since I live in Florida, obviously you all know that, and just north of Tampa. Last summer, the Tampa Bay Rays, the baseball team, announced that they were going to split the season between Montreal and Tampa. Play half their home games in Montreal and half their home games here. And, you know, like they have a series of, you know, three different teams coming in at three games each. They play those here. And then the next series of home games they do up in Montreal. And they said that's a good way to generate money and all that. And people here were saying that's ridiculous because, you know, Montreal had baseball teams and they moved because they couldn't support them. And why would they support half a year of a team? So it went back and forth. Well, all moot because today Major League Baseball came out and said, no, Tampa, you cannot do that. You cannot split your season between Montreal and Tampa. So they're stuck in Tampa. Which
that would be the only team that does it, right? No
yeah,
other team has tried to do that, right?
Right. The general manager of the Rays came on TV and he said, there has to be innovative things in baseball. And this is innovative. They're just not used to it yet, but we'll talk to them more and we'll see what's going to happen. So who knows? But, you know, I guess, you know, when you're in a small market like Tampa is and you can split it and make enough revenue, it might be a good way to increase your revenue. But then the Rays have been so good about getting in the playoffs every year. Where are they going to play the playoff games? You know, I mean, it just brings up all sorts of questions. But Major League Baseball said, nope, can't do that. So
yeah. I couldn't figure out the reason for it. It didn't make any sense. I'm like, come on, you're going to confuse the fans. And, you know, oh, I'd like to go to this game to watch them play this team. And, they're in Montreal. I can't make it.
They're
in
Montreal.
Yeah.
And
then they're talking about Ybor City, building a stadium down in Ybor City.
Right.
And I saw the site and I go, where are you going to park? There's no parking down there as it is.
There isn't. Yeah. You have to build a great big parking garage. Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. I think it's a.
I don't know.
If you want to stay, you have to build us a multi-million-dollar stadium. So
right, and that's what they do. Here. They hold towns hostages for sports stadiums, and they do that in everywhere. I mean, look at the big fancy stadiums for football and baseball, and at least you know in the United States we're not soccer crazy, or else they'd be demanding great big soccer stadiums too. If they were. So no, oh well. I just
anyway.
It was just surprised me that Major League Baseball came out and said, "Nope, can't do that." Excuse me. So Mike is feeling better. He's back with us and he's doing strong. He's feeling better. He's been under the weather for the last 3 weeks. Wow, and. So he's getting back in the loop. And so that means you can tune into his radio program on Saturday mornings.
Woohoo!
Yeah,
I listen. I listen every Saturday myself.
I
listen to it. Take it with me wherever I go.
Have it set up. Give yourself a plug here. Give yourself a plug.
All right.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean verbally? Oh, okay.
Verbally.
talking in my head. The voices in my head were going.
They're all there.
That's great. Jetstream Radio. Jetstream Radio, as in the wind currents that are at high altitudes. Jetstreamradio.com. And they have a iOS app that is really good. You can listen to it on TuneIn and I don't know, all sorts of things, what was that? But anyway,
you have to
7 to 9 a.m. Eastern time.
Every Saturday morning. You don't have to be a member either. You can tune in, but don't they, to talk with you, you have to join up, but there's no fees or anything.
It's actually, not this one. There's couple of different services and there's a way to send a request or a message on the website and that's just free. You just put your name or your nickname or something and then a request or something and it goes right to the dashboard and we go this person there's no registration.
I thought there was
no phone. Might have to get into
So yeah, very. So tune in, listen to him, and it gets listeners from all over the world. I mean, it's really a quite widespread program, and he'll take your requests. Anything that he can happen to get his hands on, he'll play for you. So, you know.
Yeah, I pay like $20 a month to have a $70 million or 70 million track library ready at my disposal.
So. You can do that? Oh, wow, that's cool.
I got it's a DJ pool. I got like, I'm on two or three of them. Three of them? Yeah, I think. And we'll come up with some obscure name and something, and I'll go, I'll find it. And yeah, sure enough, there it is.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, everything.
Try to stump Mike. There's your challenge.
No.
Tune in Saturday morning and see if you can find something.
I talked about the ones that were in Japanese, and I have to use Google Google Translate to translate the lyrics because it's all, I can't read it. And I'm looking through it going, okay, is there a word in there I can't hear? You know, I mean, who's going to recognize the words if they did say it in some other language? But there was one time I was translating like six songs at a time going, I don't know what this means.
From around the world, I can imagine, you know, you're getting a little bit of everything. But yet you still found it. So there you go.
That's true.
Yeah.
Didn't
know it existed, but yet I found it. Oh, that's cool.
It's part of a video game, and there it is. It's a tradition.
Saturday morning, 7 to 9 Eastern.
Eastern
United States time, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that's the only Eastern times there is. I guess the time zones are all divided up into different things they call them, and Eastern. I don't think there's any other Eastern anywhere. So, okay.
Middle Eastern?
Okay. Yeah.
So, this is all about wine. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. I'm sorry, we haven't, we
started here.
There you go. We usually do the talking before, but then we started on it here, and thanks for tuning in.
I got a lot to talk about. You were talking about this. Yeah, you talked about it earlier.
Yeah,
some topics.
I've got different topics for you here that just some odds and ends I'm going to throw out to you that, and it also clears up and cleans up some of my clothes that I've been wanting to tell you. So this is going to be a cleanup night on this. We're already a quarter into the show, and so that's okay because I think it's going to be about a 45-minute cleanup. So that works perfectly well. To-go wines. The pandemic has created to-go wines. Restaurants and all those places have been offering it, and they like it. Restaurants like to sell the to-go wines. They said it's been a very, very lucrative move on their part. And so they're going to continue. It's something that just about every restaurant that does wine and does the to-go is going to continue after the pandemic. It's not going to be something they're going to stop. It's not going to be something they're going to say, okay, now people can come here again. Now we're going to stop doing this. It's something that they're all looking at as a new way to increase their food sales and to expand their wine sales. And, well, actually alcohol sales. I say wine, but includes all alcoholic beverages. Usually wine is the most common, so therefore that's what usually goes out with most of the to-go orders. But it's going to be something that the restaurants have looked at, and they are already making plans throughout the United States and actually around the world. This article was talking about Canada and some of the Ontario Restaurant, Hotel, and Motel Association says that selling the alcohol has helped keep businesses and continues to do so. So good news for you. After this pandemic has started to Wayne, you can still order your wines and your meal and get the wines with it. Let's see. Where's the next thing? I thought there was something else on this page, but I guess not. Excuse me. All right, let me put that to rest and let me go to the next one. Pet bottles. Becoming very, very popular. Use them for an increase to direct-to-customer sales. I saw something in a packaging magazine, trade journal, that was talking about paper again and talking about how paper is making a comeback as a packaging alternative. Well, we know about Paperboy. If you've listened to the show for any length of time, there was a wine that came out. Oh, what was it? I guess it's been about 4 or 5 years ago now. That was called Paperboy. And the bottle, and it was shaped like a bottle, like a wine bottle. The bottle was made out of paper. And it lasted just about as long as the news that I sent out to you and told you about. And then it disappeared. Couldn't see it, couldn't find it, nothing after that. Well, they are doing it now, only the new packaging now is more can shape than it is wine bottle shape. It's more of a tubular than a tapered wine bottle. And it's won awards. It's won awards for being able to keep the flavors in and being able to keep the chill in and all that stuff. Not just for wine, but it's being looked at by many companies and many different groups that are trying to figure out different ways that they can utilize the paper. But PET bottles, and a PET bottle is, I always refer to it as PET, but it's polyethylene something. It's scientific. I'm trying to look at it here, and I can't see it. It just says PET bottles. But there's an Oregon company, Oregon Distaff Wine Company, has been using the PET bottles and using the Stelvin closure, which is the screw cap. And they're finding that the bottles weigh just 2.3 ounces. Which is about one-tenth of what a typical glass bottle. So shipping costs are a fraction. Obviously, one-tenth the cost of shipping with glass. So they're happy with that, and you're not paying for that enormous amount of weight whenever you buy something from them. And it's not just the weight going to you, but the weight that they have to pay coming into them. I remember when I ordered bottles, oh my gosh, the cost of shipping was disastrous. I paid half as much for the cost of shipping than I did just for the bottles. So if you can cut that down, if you get lighter weight, then it is a big, big improvement in your bottom line. And because of that, you can pass it on. Also, the climate impact is a lot less. The PET bottles, you can recycle. And it's just overall improved technology is causing it to be able to use it now and recycle it and all that. Whereas in the past, because of the inside shield that they had put on to hold the wine so it wouldn't give you any problems, has been improved and everything is recyclable now. So, hey, if you see, then don't turn your nose up at it. It is, give it a try. All sorts of box wines and everything out there, and PET bottles is just another way of presenting wine to you. Okay. World's Best California Wines. This is an interesting list. This is put together by the Wine Searcher website. I use Wine Searcher quite a bit to look up stuff and to check stuff. And Wine Searcher, people can order through Wine Searcher, and they do a best of series every year and stuff like that. Well, this is the last 12 months best of series for California wines on Wine Searcher. Excuse me. No, I'm not sick. It's just I'm taking drugs that cause me cough. First on the list is Abreu Vineyards, Thuravillas, Cabernet Sauvignon from Napa Valley. 97 is the score, and it's only $606. They also list the Abreu Vineyard Madrona Ranch Cabernet from Napa, 97 score, $525. What a deal. The next one, Harlan Estate, Napa Valley. I believe that's a cab also. Score of 96, and that will set you back $1,407. Yeah, I know. Cha-ching about 10 times now. $1,407 for a bottle of wine. But this next one, here you go. Screaming Eagle, Cabernet Sauvignon from Napa Valley. I believe the Screaming Eagle was put up against the French, and the Screaming Eagle Cabernet Sauvignon won against the French wines. If I am not mistaken, I think it was Screaming Eagle. And if not in the Judgment of Paris, I'm sure it has been winning awards since then, because I've had an opportunity to have Screaming Eagle in the past. I will not be able to drink it now because they list the price at $4,805. Oh my gosh. I mean, it's a great wine. I do remember it fondly, but not for $4,805. 97 was the score. Schrader Old Sparky Stauffer to Kalen Vineyard Cabernet Sauvignon. Boy, you never get that whole name on the label. That's from Napa Valley also. 97 is the score, $857. Sin Qua Non Cumulus Vineyard, next of kin, KYN, Central Coast, 96 score, $507. Realm Cellars, the Absurd Proprietary Red from Napa Valley, 96, that's only $1,217. Sloan Proprietary Red from Rutherford, 96 score, $665. Abreu Vineyard Las Posados from Howell Mountain. Abreu Vineyard is listed a lot here. 97 score, $634. And Colgin Cellars 9 Estate Red, Roman numeral 9 Estate Red, Napa Valley, $601, 96 score. Let me editorialize. They're good. All right. All these wines are good. There's some absolutely great wines. The only one I've ever had in the past was the Screaming Eagle. I've never had any of the others. And that was way in the past, many, many years ago, before Screaming Eagle got so full of themselves they had to jump the price up sky high. And it was excellent, fantastic. But, oh my gosh, you know, these prices, the normal person's not going to have these. These may be the best California wines, but the normal person's not going to be able to have these, and we all know that. So it's always fun to read it and see what they are and what they say. And, you know, if you get a chance to do a tasting and say 480 of your friends all get together, then you can get the Screaming Eagle Cabernet for a cheaper price, and that'll give you a sip of it, you know, 1 ounce. But that probably 480, you'll never get 1 ounce. It'd have to be like a quarter of an ounce. But it gets a little bit absurd when they start doing this. So these increase in price over the past year by 25%. You know, I mean, if you can get them, it's probably an investment. Screaming Eagle itself is up 31% over last year. So, but, you know, it's still too much money. So those were world's best California wines, according to Wine Searcher. And we can all just shake our head at the cost of those. Southern England. Southern England has really, England itself, but Southern England has really has received a lot of good press lately on their wines and their wine potential. Climate change, yes, has something to do with it because the growing seasons are moving north in the northern hemisphere and south in the southern hemisphere. But England is in a good spot. The reason they've always had temperate climates is because of the ocean currents, and it comes in on them and warms the country enough that it's not an ice bucket like, well, across the ocean. You follow England across the ocean in a straight line, and you're getting in areas of Nova Scotia and stuff like that, and Canada, which are cold a lot, and England gets themselves a fairly decent climate. So because of that, they are planting a lot of grapes, a lot of wine grapes, and they are making a lot of wine. People are saying that this is an area that should be taken notice of. In fact, Southern England is being said to have the potential to be the Napa of the United Kingdom, which, you know, everybody compares everything to Napa, but the area is really temperate climate and doing well. And one of the things about it, too, is the location. It's south of London by about an hour, which is just about the same distance as Napa and Sonoma is from San Francisco, about an hour away. So Kent, which is the area that a lot of these wineries are, and Kent and Sussex and Surrey and Hampshire are about as far away, about an hour's drive from London. And so therefore they're hoping to pull in tourists and different people from the London area or from visiting London. Just like San Francisco has their tourists and people say, oh, let's go to Napa. And so everybody does. And so they're hoping in the southern area that this will happen. Also there, Chapel Downs, new CEO Andrew Carter, believes that the wine industry can learn a lot from the Napa and Sonoma areas because of the way that they are present themselves, a super premium luxury experience. He says jokingly, you go to Stag's Leap or Behringer and they're out in the yard cutting the grass with a pair of scissors just to be sure it's exactly right. And he said it's an impression that they try to give to the people. And he said that they really should be doing that here. And I say here in England, because it will create that image in your mind and you will want to go back or you want to tell other people about it. So they're saying that that is a good possibility that it's going to start picking up even more. The U.S. model is the gold standard when it comes to presenting wineries and doing wine clubs and all that stuff. And they are looking very strongly at that area, the Napa area from this area, to base their model, if you will, their model after. So if you ever go to England, or if you're listening to me and you live in England, check out the area. Send me an email. Let me know what you think of it, and if there's anything that is that you notice that really sticks out in your mind. Again, that's Southern England, south of London. excuse me again. The European Union has granted member states to use resistant hybrid varieties in their Appellation wines. Now, that is not a, so what? That is a big deal. A lot of the areas are very restrictive on what can and cannot be in the wines. And I mean, like, very restrictive. You can have, you have to use this wine to call it this, and you have to, you can't mix in too much of this, and your percentage has to be this, and all that stuff. And they're very hard to change their minds and use anything else. Well, the European Union has came about on this because of climate change. And the climate change is causing a increase in downy mildew and powdery mildew, and also some pests and things like that. And they don't want to use a whole lot of pesticides, and they don't use a whole lot of copper spraying, which is a very common thing to kill pests, and mildew rather. So they're looking at alternatives, and they have been approved to come up with, or to use, hybrid grapes. Now, the PDO, or Protected Domination of Origin, this is the areas that are very strict on it, said that only vines of Vitis vinifera species could be used before in the PDOs. But now they have been approved to use genetic trace of non-vinifera species, such as fungal-resistant PIWI varieties. Previously were excluded. PIWI, and I'm going to destroy this, but it stands for Pils Weiderstandsfähig. Pils Weiderstandsfähig, which is a variety of grapes that are resistant to the fungus, the downy mildew, and that stuff. So, according to the updated regulations, member states can now use wine or vine varieties belonging to Vitis vinifera, as well as hybrids containing both Vitis vinifera and non-vinifera genetic materials. And these can come from American and Asian vines. So a big step for the European Union, and that is all European Union countries. So you're talking Germany and France and Spain and Portugal, and you know, we can go on and on, and all those big wine regions and all that. And so they're going to do it. Now, I don't think it's going to affect anything in the bottle. In fact, it will be, I am sure, the wineries, the owners that, and the winemakers that will be resistant to using anything but what they've been using. But if it comes to the day where this powdery mildew and downy mildew starts affecting their grapes too much, they will just say, well, we can use this, and we'll do it. And it's not going to be anything that you're going to notice the taste on, I guarantee you. But it's just, it's a big thing that for centuries, literally centuries, they could not. And now they're saying, you know, we need to do something because of the climate change. So I thought that was interesting. Okay, let me see something else here. Vogel reduced carbon footprint, the world's best California. All right, let's get out of here and go to here. Historic merger in Champagne. I don't know if you heard about this. This happened a while back, and about a month ago. The largest merger of the 21st century in Champagne was completed about a month ago, and sees the creation of a new super cooperative group with the capacity to produce 24 million bottles a year of champagne. And it's like, That's a wow. That's a wow, people. The deal sees the union of two Champagne leading cooperative groups, one of them CRVC Champagne Castanel, and the other one Central Vincol Champagne Nicholas Florate or Florat. Those two are being joined together. Now, you probably never heard of them unless you look at some bottles and you'll see it on the back of the on the names. And then, you know, a lot of them, well, Nicholas Florent is on the front of a lot of bottles. I've seen that. You bigger liquor stores, you can find that. But it became effective December 31st. And they are a new cooperative group. They are now known as Terroirs et Vignerons de Champagne. And it unites around 6,000 grape growers and 3,000 hectares of vineyard, representing about 9% of the total Champagne appellation. Big, big, big. It's the newly formed group is worth 300 million euro. And let's see, what's it say? Something, I saw something else that was interesting here. It says, oh, following the decline in the French market for champagne, and they figured that this was probably a good thing to do, then that way they can combine their advertising dollars and promote themselves more and try to trigger a turnaround. It creates them as the one of three major operators in the Champagne region. So, another big purchase in the Champagne region. Another big purchase in wine, actually. That's one of them. Where is it? I was just talking about England, and I was going to tell you about prices, and I misplaced it. Oh, here we go. Land. I mentioned about England and how it's becoming a big grape and wine region. Excuse me. But it is cheap. The drinks business reported that Ian Kellett, who is the owner of Hambledon Vineyard in Hampshire, was saying how cheap land is in England now. And he said, if you're looking at getting good grape growing land, the farmland in east and, oh no, west, I said east, west and south, both directions, out of London is really cheap. He said that you can get an acre for 12,000 to 15,000 pounds. Now, I don't know the conversion because I've never really paid attention to it, but 12,000 to 15,000 pounds. And you can grow just about any grape you want there and do it well. But he says a hectare of land in the Champagne region ranges from 800,000 euro to 2.2 million euro. That's an acre there. So, well, a little over a hectare. So it's really, really cheaper in England. And he said that it took in the Champagne region 300 years to work out where to grow things. And he said, now they already know where to grow things, and you're not paying $2.2 million for an acre of land. You're getting good yields and all that stuff. So if you're looking for land, they say it's go to New England or England and just west and south of London, and you can find some really, really good land that is great for grape growing. And I think it will continue to be because the way the where the climate change has been going, I think we're going to start seeing more and more areas like London and all that, or London, like England, that is going to be good grape growing regions. Australia's love affair with box wines. They call it cardboard dough and bag in a box and goon bag. All these are in Australia. And Australia is one of the reasons why these things are jumping up in usage. It's unbelievable how much is being used. They call them goon bags. What's it? I never saw this part here. Increase of wonder in the same decade as domestic sales and dropping the cash in this. Goon bags. Once they tap, let's see, Borks. Okay, here we go. Box wine, also known as card Bordeaux or bag in a box, BIB, or more commonly there, goon from flagoon, is one of Australia's most extraordinary contributions to the wine industry. So that's where it's from, flagoon, is goon bags. And it started in the 70s. Then 30 years later, between 2004 and 2014, there were a 30% drop in cask sales, but a 40% increase in bottled wine during the same period. And domestic sales had been dropping, and the cask concept and its contents also were also being exported. So goon has came a long way from its original reputation. Now it's being looked at as a great alternative. Gilly Wine Company Chateau Cardboard Red, $71 for 3 liters, is a long way from the 1 gallon packs of table wine that was launched back in 1965. Australians love it. Portability, sustainability. Pandemic, wine sales jumped up at 21% in the 4 weeks in April 2020, which that's when the biggest hit of. Longevity, and this is something that you don't think of. Contrary to popular opinion, goon or bag in a box is not only the choice of people who might want to drink a lot, the vacuum sealed bag keeps wine fresh up to 6 weeks after it's opened, which is a good deal. And the price, it's cheaper wine is taxed less, and so therefore they classify the stuff in those containers as cheaper. And so I chuckled. They have a picture of a bag in a box, sitting on the beach as a sculpture. Only it's just the bag sitting out there, and it's just a great big old bag that is a sculpture, beach sculpture. But it is very, very popular in Australia. All the bag in a box or the goon, they call them goon babies, were. Generation X goon drinkers are now in their 40s and 50s, and they're still drinking bag in a box, and the whole country has caught on to it. So Australia, keeping the dream of bag in a box alive, cardboard dough and bag in a box and goon bag. Australia, I love it. Australia is great on that stuff. No pretense. Just we like it. We're going to drink it. Okay, let's see. Let me go back to something else here that I'm going to spend a little bit more time on because it's interesting. Okay. All right. Wine report confirms massive Australian glut of more than 2 billion liters of unsold Australian wine is sitting in storage following a record 2021 vintage and a slump in export and domestic sales. Put it in a goonie. is down. Levels are down a lot in Australia, and they're trying to figure out why it's down so much. But basically, there's different areas that aren't buying it as much as they were. And, well, it's starting to get hung up on ports and out in the ocean on container ships and stuff. They ship this stuff on container ships, and it's being hung up there. And the sales are actually down quite a bit. So that's what's happening. It's their inventory is up by 24%, but sales are down by anywhere from 4 to 10% around the world. So that's what's happening with Australian wines. You can probably, well, I was going to say find some good deals, but the ones that are sitting on the shelf aren't going to be marked down, so that's not going to be a reality. But maybe if you, well, I was going to say tell the wine shop, hey, you're not going to get any more. And when you do, it's going to be a good price. And they'll say, well, if I'm not going to get any more, that's going to cost more too. So, well, that won't work. I have talked in the past about phylloxera. You can go back to shows over the years, and I've dedicated whole shows to it, and I've talked about it partially, and I said all sorts of stuff about it. Phylloxera is interesting. Phylloxera is a small pest. I say pest, but actually it's worse than a pest. It's an aphid insect, an aphid-like insect that loves to eat roots and leaves of grapevines. It has a four cycle stage of its life. It's got the egg, the nymph, the and the adult. What's the center one there? I can't think of it right now. But they got a four stage. If you spray, you can usually get the nymph and the adult, but you can't get kill the eggs or the middle one. The hibernation stage, cocoon. It's not a cocoon. But so you can't spray unless you spray continuously, which is not good for grapevines because you have to spray it enough. And they also eat the roots. So spraying really is not an option because it's not going to get down into the roots. France got phylloxera in the mid to late 1800s. And they started to see the grapevines die. They didn't know why. They were dying. And they couldn't figure out what it was. Well, the problem was phylloxera. And it was because the phylloxera was introduced into France from the United States. Now, I don't want to say by the United States. I want to say from the United States because they really don't know how it got there. They don't know if the French imported it and some of their trading with the United States on plants and grapevines and stuff, because there was a lot of that going on back then. And they didn't know if it was because of that or if somebody brought it over. They don't know. But they checked. A scientist decided that he needed to check and see. Here, let me read you this. This is probably better. Phylloxera is an aphid-like insect that feasts on certain types of roots and leaves that didn't show up in France until around the mid-19th century or 1800s, when they more than likely arrived from the United States. More than likely. You know, I mean, that was the place where they were. So this is another weird layer to the story. The United States was probably the cause of their problem, which we would eventually help them resolve it. although some circles believe America's role in the original story was inadvertent at best. Some people think the French brought the American vines into their country. And in this case, the vines are most likely transplanted as ornamental grapevines for the French elite. And when they did that, it contained phylloxera. So whenever the pest did arrive and whatever they were doing, they wreaked havoc on the grapevines on a massive scale. Wiped out 40 to 50% of the French vines. Oh my gosh. I mean, now you think about 40 to 50%. We talk about these wildfires in California and hitting some vineyards, but it didn't even destroy, but I think total like 2% of the whole vineyards in the state. Percentage gets higher as you get, in the Napa area or the Sonoma area, but in the whole state, it's only like 2 to 5%. This wiped out 50% in the whole country. So, something that absolutely drove the French crazy. It became known as the Great French Wine Blight. And so they didn't know what it was. The microscopic size of the phylloxera was almost impossible to just walk up to a plant and see, especially if you don't know what you're looking for. All you have was withering grapevines year after year. The bugs were as the root of the issue by a French botanist by the name of Jules Emile Pinchon. This was back in 1868. And this calls American scientists to go into a frenzy to try to find a way to save them. Well, everyone was freaking out about the need to go to France and find a way to help them out. They slowly started to realize that the U.S. had phylloxera but didn't have the phylloxera problem. And so they're trying to figure out why we had phylloxera, because when you got to remember now, this was in 1868. There was no email. There was no phones. There was nothing that they can just pick up or sit down and say, hey, I'm French botanist Jules Emile Pinchon, and I'm writing to scientists in America, and this is what I found. It doesn't work that way. It took a long time to pass information around from one area to the other. I mean, it was, and a lot of times they just worked exclusively by themselves, and so it wasn't a matter of sharing any information. So one of the scientists involved in this pursuit was Missouri's state entomologist Charles Valentine Riley, who noticed that Missouri phylloxera didn't attack vines at their roots. This led Riley to theorize that Missouri rootstock, which is the base of the plant, could be grafted onto French vines and stop the phylloxera. So, with this knowledge, he reached out to Pinchon directly, and the two collaborated on an effort to stop the insects from eating up and destroying the French vines. And it was correct. It worked. By 1873, the French project to defend French vines from phylloxera was in full swing, and Missouri was taking lots and lots of bows because of it. But if you're listening to someone from Missouri, this is where they stop telling you the story. They go, we saved the French wine industry. And that's the end of the story. But it goes further, and I never knew this. I've heard stories that the Missouri saved the French wine industry, and I've heard stories that Texas saved the French wine industry. And I'm always thinking, how can they both have saved the French wine industry? There has to be a problem here. Well, there was a problem in that theory, because Missouri did save the French wine industry, but it doesn't stop there. Missouri wasn't the only conquering hero on this. the strategy didn't pan out. After initially thriving, Missouri rootstock started to die off because they couldn't handle France's chalky, alkaline soils in the long run. It was just too much for them. They couldn't make it through. They were used to the Missouri soils and the rich loam and even some of the red clay that they had around Missouri, but it's alkaline soils. It was just too much. So it was only a temporary fix, and the French all of a sudden was under the swarm of phylloxera again. But horticulturist by the name of Thomas Volney Munson stepped into the picture. He wasn't a native of Texas, actually he originally hailed from Illinois, but he became known as the Grape Man of Texas because of his extensive work with Texas grapes. He didn't, you know, he moved to Texas and he did. So in the 1880s, and this was a decade after Raleigh's work in Missouri, Munson determined Texas rootstocks could also neutralize phylloxera's powers. But better yet, this species of vine could also handle the nature of French's soil and not succumb to the chalky alkaline soils of France, because Texas had their share of it too. So they grafted it onto Texas grapevines, or Texas rootstock. So the French added the Texas rootstocks to their suffering vines, and phylloxera was no longer a problem. Chardonnay, Cabernet, Pinot Noir, Merlot, all the ones that we're so familiar with from France were saved, and that's the end of the story. But not really, because if you are from Texas, you tell about Munson, and that's all you tell. And if you're from Missouri, you tell about Riley, and that's all you tell. But they both did their job. If it weren't for Munson, wasn't some genius that came out of nowhere to proclaim, "I'm going to save France," he already knew where to get things started. He already knew what was the problem. He already knew everything about it, and he was just looking at the grapevines and what they could do, the rootstock and what they can do. So it wasn't a Missourian that saved Texas wines, and it wasn't a Texan, or French wines, and it wasn't a Texan that saved French wines. It was a sort of collaborative effort. There's no interstate rivalry between Missouri and Texas. They really, you know, I grew up in Missouri and I never heard, you know, bad things about Texas or anything. I mean, I grew up in Kansas City and we always said bad things about Kansas, but that's another story. The basic story is that if you're in Missouri and you're telling the story, then you stop where Missouri saved it. If you're in Texas and you're telling the story, you start where Munson discovered this and he saved it. And they both did. They're both still able to lay claim to it and probably gain some attention. And I think the whole story is really much more fascinating than just the half stories I've always heard. And so it's French honors the story through a pair of statues, actually. The statues inadvertently also separate the narrative. One of the statues honors Riley from Missouri, while the other statue honors the Americans who helped resolve the issue, including Munson. So he didn't get a statue to himself, but Raleigh did. But it's just an interesting story all the way around. I've always heard one or the other half. And I've always told, I am at fault, because I've always told one or the other half of the story. Basically the same, but I always get to the end and say, so I don't know, either Missouri or Texas saved French grapes, but you know, I don't know who was the actual one. And actually, it's both of them. So good for them. And we are done for another week. So, well, look at that. Right at 8 o'clock. Good timing.
Go back here. I was trying to do... All right. Jump on my typing here. I did some quick math in my head. I did some quick math in my head while you were talking. An acre for 12,000 pounds, sterling pounds.
Yeah.
I just quickly just came up with it because I know
that,
my
yeah.
currency,
yeah.
world currency.
Yeah.
$16,308 per acre is 12,000 pounds, or $20,385 is 15,000 pounds. So an acre there in England is roughly 16,000 to 21 or 20,000 US dollars.
Uh-huh.
That sounds high to me. Is that?
Well, while you're surfing one day, punch in land in Napa or land in Sonoma or even land in Paso Robles or land in Livermore, all these grape growing regions of California.
Yeah.
And I mean, be sure you're sitting down, because if you're not, it'll just literally make you take a step or two back. I mean, it's outrageous, outrageous how much land is in those areas. And, you can't, if you can even find land. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So, yes, it is
in
high.
In 2017, according to countyappraisals.net, the average price point was between $310,000 per acre to $400,000 or more per acre. It's not uncommon.
And this was where?
It says Napa. How much was land cost in Napa, Napa Valley, or elsewhere in? Let's see, many bars. I think the average price point. That was in 2017. So.
And it's went up. And you take the average price point, though. Then that, I think that is not going to show you a true number for for vineyards, because that probably includes.
Yeah.
An acre of land that's in town, or that's not good for vineyards, and so you get some prime vineyard areas, and I'm sure it's going to run at over $500,000 an acre.
Here is Napa outlying areas such as Pope Valley, Gordon Valley, etc. Plantable has been running $25,000 to $50,000 an acre, and vineyard. $50,000 to $130,000 an acre.
Wow,
that's outside. Napa prime areas such as Oakville, Rutherford, St. Helena, and Yountville. In that area, plantable is looking at $200,000 to $250,000 an acre, and vineyards $300,000 to $400,000 an acre.
Wow.
Okay.
So
check
your
credit line real quick.
Open up a credit line. I want to buy, let's see, give me 3 square feet.
Exactly. And that was in 2019. So it says Napa and Sonoma real estate values. So
in the last couple of years, I'm sure it's jumped up a little bit, because it always does. I mean, prices always go up a percentage every year.
Yeah.
So. Oh my gosh!
Wow,
it's just, and that's just for the land now. Okay, then once you start putting the vineyards in, and once you start doing all that stuff, that's when I was had the winery, we had the vineyard. The standard rule of thumb is it's going to cost $10,000 an acre for all the infrastructure. That's for the vines, which are expensive, but for the posts and for the trellises and for the watering system and everything else, put it all in, $10,000 an acre. And if you do it yourself, you can cut that price down, but that was the standard amount. So you know, it gets bloody expensive. That still doesn't justify $4,000 for a bottle of Screaming Eagle Cabernet, but it
gives you
a little perspective of, you know, what it does cost just to grow the grapes, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But, that's still a lot of money, no matter what you do.
Sounds more like you're paying for the name and the prestigiousness of it than the actual worth. I don't know. Maybe the ground is different.
I agree.
I don't know.
This is from Napa. Ooh, as opposed to this is from Livermore, or Monterey. People aren't as ooh about those as they're about Napa, but they're still good growing areas. And Central Valley and all that. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, just didn't have the name. Yeah, so it makes a difference. It really does make a difference. And that's, you know, and even California, this is a California vintage as opposed to Colorado or
Lakeland.
Kentucky or Lakeland. Exactly. You know,
Miami.
All makes a difference, you know. All of it makes a difference, you know, in people's
coastal,
minds.
Coastal regions of Florida, that's a very prestigious area.
Yeah, it always has been, Yeah.
Well,
you punched it in. Coastal regions of Florida wineries,
and
it comes question mark on the screen.
Did you misspell something else?
What? Yeah. 404.
All right. It is 8:07 p.m. Eastern Time and January the 20th. Thank you for tuning in again. We'll see you all next week. The 27th will be our next last show of January 2022. It's already gone. Just like that. Thank you all for tuning in and putting up with us, and appreciate it. We'll see you all next week, and have a great week.
Be safe.
And
we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you. I got to close out chat here real quick. I got that other person on YouTube that I don't know what they're posting, but anyway. All right, here we go. We'll see you all next time. Thank you.
This concludes tonight's episode.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Rod. For show information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on this show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.
My.
Thanks.